So before we get the session started, I just wanted to let you know that's actually not the order of speakers. We'll follow the order in the book. My name is Dr. Reuven Granich, and I will actually – Kevin DeCock is he wasn't able to make it. He's ill, so I'll be delivering his talk. So those of you who came to see him, you're free to leave.
No, but stay. It's good.
I'm waiting for my co-chair, Mark Harrington, which I hope will show up as well. But while I'm waiting, I thought I would do a commercial advertisement for the HIV section at the Union. And the president or the chair just walked out, Renee Ritson. But I would urge, it's a new section at the Union. We're very small. We have about 60 members. Many of you are members. Thank you very much. And those of you who aren't or who have friends that should be members, we're doing a recruitment drive. We would like to increase membership by at least 30%, which we think will be quite easy over the next next few months. Membership for the Union is not you can pay a lot to get the online a lot to get the hard copy of the manuscript, etc., but it's actually really only 60 euros if you're strapped for cash, and it may be even less if you're from places that get discounts, etc. So we would just urge everybody to become a member, and then as a member to join the HIV section. Renee, did you want to make a comment? Or? Yeah, we are. We will start. Yeah. So I think my co-chair will show up, but I think that we should get started anyway. Welcome, everybody. This is the session on the three I's here at the Union. My name is Dr. Reuven Granich. I'm with the HIV department at WHO Geneva. And I assume that since most of you are in the room, you know a bit about the three I's. And the three I's actually stand for isoniazid preventive therapy, intensified case finding, and infection control. And it's not we'll hear about this today in a number of really exciting talks. It's not none of those things are very new and sexy. But what we think is new and sexy is actually that the three are being thought of together and as part of HIV care and treatment. And I think that you'll see from our program today and from our speakers that that will become clear and that you'll hear more and more increasingly about the three I's. As I was saying before some of you came in, Kevin DeCock, who's the director of the department, is ill and won't be able to make it today. So I'm going to be delivering his talk. So the first thing I have to do is introduce myself. I will be giving Kevin DeCock's talk now. All right. So, well, anyway, welcome. The idea behind this this talk is to give a global progress report on the three I's. Relatively new concept we basically launched out of the WHO with the HIV department and the TB department and other stakeholders in April. As all of you know, we've made amazing gains in terms of treatment, scaling up treatment access. Obviously, we have much to do, but this year we released a report saying that there's 3 million people on therapy. And for those of you who have been working for a while in the field, you realize that this is quite an accomplishment from the days when people didn't think that this was possible. That's the good news. The however is that there are a number of different significant challenges that that we feel pose a threat to this scale up and this success. And one of the big ones is obviously not enough people are aware that they have HIV. There's a lot of early mortality. We're feeling pressure to initiate treatment earlier, change PMTC regimens, et cetera. But one of the major threats to the scale-up is tuberculosis. And that's one of the genesis of the 3I initiative. Here is something that all of you are very familiar, and I won't dwell on it, but basically is the HIV prevalence in new TB cases. And the next slide, going quickly, just shows that the vast majority of the cases, 85%, let's say, are found in sub-Saharan Africa. And you can see in this slide, which is from the Stop TB department, that South Africa accounts for 29%. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't other countries there, India's and the Russian Federation being most notable, that also have a significant problem with HIV and TB. This, again, is something that is just further evidence of the reason why people working with HIV and need to pay attention to TB. It's the most common OI in the first 3 months, and this isn't news to anybody, I hope. Now, where do you know? What about the genesis of the three I's? Where does the whole idea come from? And actually, you'll see that a lot of work has actually previously gone into this. And I think these guidelines, which are the 12 collaborative activities, which were really spearheaded by the Stop TB department at WHO, along with many of their or all of their stakeholders, came up with the framework of what should be focused on in terms of doing HIV collaborative activities. And in the next few slides, I'll talk about some of our progress in those areas. But you can see that it's roughly divided into the A's, the B's, and the C's, which is helpful for some people. And in the A's are the collaborative mechanisms. And the C's, I'll just jump to them, is looking really primarily focused on what you can do in the TB setting or the among HIV among TB patients. And the B's are actually, I think, a little bit more difficult in that it's what can you do for people living with HIV in terms of decreasing TB, the burden of TB among them. And when we looked at this, when we were first discussing this and talking about how can the HIV department get more involved and more engaged on this, it doesn't necessarily jump out at you from this list, but we just saw three I's because we tend to think in terms of threes. We had this 3x5. It seemed like three I's was a natural, and it seems to have captured people's attention. So this is actually the data coming from the surveillance report, and I, again, thank all the people that have actually worked to collect this data. And what it really, what this slide really emphasizes, on the left you can see the activities that are happening in the TB settings, and you can see that we're seeing actually pretty good progress in some of those areas, especially testing for HIV, which is a gateway to prevention, care, and treatment. But if you look on the, I guess it would be your right, and I suppose there's a pointer. If you look in this area, you can see that we're not doing so well, and that's a nice way of saying it. We're not doing so well in the HIV care settings. And this this is where the three I's come in. This is what we're focused on, and this is another illustration of that. And these are really tough. These are really actually tough data to present, and I think that I'm hoping that 10 years from now that all these percentages will be much higher. But you're seeing we're getting at the WHO in terms of reporting that 1% of the TB patients are being screened for of HIV people living with HIV are being screened for TB. We know that that's higher, but we don't know whether it's 10% or 20% higher. But that should be a much higher percentage. And then among them, if you do screen, of course you find TB, which is no surprise. And then you get this, I guess the only way to say it is a bit of a miserable percentage down here of people started on IPT. Now, it's not all bad news. This is looking at HIV testing among TB patients, and you can see it places, and the percentages are good here, but I think they're probably going up, and there is an argument that some people, this may be even underestimate given the way that we collect the data, but places like Rwanda are getting up in the 70s and 80%, and Brazil's also very high, and Malawi. So they've made very significant progress in testing people for HIV, so that's quite good. And also in terms of getting, and something very, very important, getting people, TB patients onto ART, we see tremendous progress there. Although we'd like to see this higher, we see that 41% of the TB patients are getting access to ART. So that's quite good. Now, what about the three I's meeting? I'll shift gears a little bit. We thought that it would be very important for the HIV department to hold a meeting of stakeholders, and primarily HIV stakeholders, to discuss the issue of TB among people living with HIV, and also to express HIV department leadership on this issue. Of course, we developed this program and the meeting with the TB department, and also we work very closely with UNAIDS. The conclusions out of the meeting, the people that were there, and many of you were, and thank you, are that the three R's are essential for quality HIV care and need to be seen in the context of high-quality HIV services. And what that's not saying is that actually that the TB department, who's had some TB community, has so much responsibility for this, is acknowledge that and then also acknowledge the need to work give the responsibility a bit, as it were, to the HIV community. As part of that, one of the recommendations was to reconceptualize the WHO guidelines. and making 3Is central to HIV care, because it's a new concept. Develop a new TB screening approach. As many of you know, our guidelines need work in that area. And then with the concept that TB screening actually leads you to a decision point between IPT for those who have no symptoms or are obviously clear of having TB, and intensified case finding for those who do have symptoms, then you can do the investigative work. And the idea being is that traditionally people have been very worried about ruling out TB and making sure that and establishing that TB diagnosis. And what we want to do is shift, or what we're trying to do is shift the discussion more toward toward providing more IPT for people who are asymptomatic or who would clearly benefit. And then obviously infection control is a key part of this as well. And we're I have a slide a little bit later about infection control that will kind of explain what we've been doing in that area. And then finally, the 3Is push and pull advocacy, and actually this talk is part of the that push advocacy. And the idea being that we need to have high-level opinion leaders aware of the issue of TB among people living with HIV, and then also we need to work much, much more closely with the community and people affected by both of these diseases. So this is a slide looking at the technical priorities. I'm not going to talk about harmonizing the 3Is indicators, which is down on the slide here. We're also entertaining the idea of INH co-trim co-formulation, and we're working to support country adaptation efforts. I will talk, though, briefly about the ICE and ISA preventive therapy and the intensified case finding and the need to reconceptualize the guidelines. So this, and this is a data slide, but this looks at countries that have a policy on IPT. So, I mean, it's not so bad. I mean, many countries actually do think IPT is a reasonable thing for people living with HIV, and there's a policy there. It gets kind of, it gets a little bit worse, though, when it comes to implementation. And you can see that really 0.08%, I'm not sure why we go down to that many decimals. I'm hoping at some point that'll be actually a whole percentage point or maybe even higher. But anyway, the point being is that very few people are put on IPT, and actually Botswana really is one of the only countries, heavily impacted countries, that's using IPT. So we need to change that. This is a survey that we did among heavily affected countries, and it illustrates the same point. We were looking at COTRIM and IPT policy. COTRIM is much more widely accepted, and IPT is less widely accepted and obviously less widely implemented. And so this is a IPT ICF challenge. I mean, and this I thank Christian Gunnenberg for this slide. But this shows really what the issues are for us. That we have ART services which are shown in red, and they're at the same places as TB treatment and HIV testing services. And really, the 3Is need to be scaled up so that they happen everywhere. And so that's actually going to be a major major problem or major issue in terms of when we're conceptualizing the guidelines, which we are hoping to be doing in the beginning of 2009. We will come out with new guidelines that will actually incorporate intensified case finding and also IPT together as a single set of guidelines with an algorithm. And so that's and it's a joint TB and HIV department effort. We're working on this together. We will involve stakeholders, experts, technical experts, and also our country counterparts. We're in the process of doing or in completing the IPT meta-analysis, which is part of the grading process, and the ICF meta-analysis as well. Many of you are involved in those efforts. And again, using screening for TB as a gateway to IPT, IC, and ICF. Expert meeting early 2009 and promote implementation of current policies. So that's part of WHO's job, is to come up with normative guidelines, put them out, and then hopefully you all will be part of that process and then own and adapt the guidelines for your country implementation. The other technical priority for us is the infection control for TB. I'll just quickly go to this next slide, which gets a bit of a chuckle, but it's basically our previous. I would safe to say I was involved in writing the 1999 guidelines, and it's safe to say that's been our approach to infection control in HIV services or in healthcare settings. But I think that that's changing, and actually our goal is to get this guy's head out of the sand. And many of you are actually making a lot of progress in that area, and the idea is to capitalize on that progress and to develop a revised infection control policy that will have components of an HIV department or HIV perspective, It will involve the larger infection control community, and there's a meta-analysis that goes with that, and we're hopeful for that to come out early next year. The other thing is, in the interim, the people at the 3Eyes meeting put pressure on us to say, look, what are you doing with the current guidelines that you have, which are actually, I think they're reasonable, a little bit biased, but I think that they're reasonable and they need to be implemented. So we put out, with stakeholders, again, we put out a safety without stigma, the 10 essential actions for effective infection control. And we're developing potential infection control indicators for monitoring and evaluation. And then we're also working closely with the community to, because we firmly believe that the community is going to need to really understand the importance of infection control and help us help all of you implement effective infection control in facilities. This is a slide that just shows the fact sheet on the 10 key actions. And the reason I'm putting it up is, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but you'll see that they're actually reasonably straightforward, difficult to implement in some settings, but they're not high. Most of them are not high tech and don't involve expensive ventilation or N95 respirators for everybody or those sorts of things. These are things that actually many clinics can do now. Now, let's switch gears a little bit. You may recognize the two gentlemen there. They won't be speaking today, but we did some. We have been working very hard on high level advocacy, and this is part of the 3Eyes push. And so you see, we were at the UNAIDS PCB meeting in Thailand, the PEPFAR implementers meeting, and the UN high level meeting. And that's Ban Ki-moon and Clinton. They're talking about HIV-TB, and then these other meetings here, which I won't go into details. We will be at ACASA, and we will be holding a meeting in Addis. And the reason that this is important is that we feel very strongly that high-level political commitment is going to be necessary, or is necessary, to implement HIV-TB, the collaborative activities, and also to make sure that they're central for HIV-AIDS care, prevention care and treatment scale-up. And so that's been a focus of ours. And we think that we're being reasonably successful with that, but you all should see yourselves as part of that effort as well. In terms of advocacy, we have a donor dialogue going. We're working with the Global Fund. We're taking a look at what happened with the Global Fund grant round 8, and to make sure that HIV-TB was represented and that the 3Eyes were there and the other collaborative activities. And we're considering, and it'd be interesting to hear feedback, we're considering maybe thinking about making it mandatory for HIV and TB proposals, or asking that it be made mandatory that HIV and TB proposals include HIV-TB elements in heavily impacted countries. We're working with PEPFAR, talking with them about ways to, they're already doing a tremendous amount, which you'll hear about, in HIV-TB, but ways to further increase our collaborations. And then obviously we're talking with Gates as well about ways that we can work with them. And that doesn't exclude all the other donors in the room. We would like to work with you, and we are working with you on HIV-TB. So please see me afterwards if you have some ideas. In terms of the advocacy on the communications front, you know, obviously we're working on the scientific literature. There was a really nice article in the New England Journal by Dr. Chasen that came out around discussed the 3Eyes. There's a recent JAMA paper. We've got a paper into Lancet, et cetera. For those of you who read the journals, you'll be seeing more and more of a scientific discussion on the value of IPT, different issues around intensified case finding, and also infection control. And then we're preparing communications materials, fact sheets, and these sorts of things so that people can be better informed. In terms of the poll, we're obviously reaching out to with community activists and community organizations. This is a protest that happened at the meeting in Mexico, talking about 1% TB screening of people living with HIV/AIDS. And we're hoping for we're working with people for a treatment literacy type approach, and we want to bring this down to the country level and provide technical support for that. And obviously, I think one of the things here is to monitor progress using HIV-TB indicators, which will be really, really important. So in terms of the next steps, and I'm getting to the end of my talk here, or Kevin's talk, the next step is obviously to get the new conceptualized guidelines written, which is at WHO. There's a new process, and it's actually more rigorous, but we think that the guidelines will be even better. Get them written and then also implemented at a regional and country level. We need to provide WHO, HIV and TB department needs to provide additional support to regional and national governments to support 3Eyes implementation. Obviously, we're working on harmonizing the HIV-TB indicators among all of the stakeholders, PEPFAR, Global Fund, and putting out those indicators and that guidance is going to be really, really important. Strengthening engagement at country-level partners is going to be important, and program managers. And specifically, we really are looking forward to working more closely with national AIDS program managers because they hold many of the keys in terms of implementing the three I's. And then the final thing is obviously resource mobilization. This is not going to this is going to require resources on many different levels. We are going to need assistance at headquarters level, at regional level, at the country level, and community groups and national AIDS programs and TB programs are going to need to solicit funds and get resources, either reconfiguring what resources they have now or getting additional new resources to focus on HIV-TB. And people always ask me, well, what's the story with this giant fish? And it's actually real. It's not a computer generated, at least as far as I can tell. And it's an 846-pound catfish, I think, that was caught in the Mekong Delta. And so I always use it as a symbol of kind of resource mobilization. We need to land a few of those fishes and get more resources for HIV-TB. So I want to thank you, and I thank all the people that that helped me or helped Kevin put together this talk, myself, Haliasis Gaitun, Christian Gunnerberg, Alistair Reed, people from the SOC-TB department and elsewhere. And there's too many to list. But anyway, thank you very much. And I guess what we'll do, one thing, I guess what we'll do is we'll maybe take one or two questions for clarification, and then we'll move on to the next speaker. So were there any questions? Did anybody have any questions? Okay, I'll move. So it's just wearing a different answer. So it's my great pleasure to introduce the next speaker. It's Dr. Caroline Ryan. She's from the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, where she's the Director of Program Services and has been working on HIV and various aspects for quite a long time, has a background in internal medicine and infectious disease. But she's going to tell us now about PEPFAR's activities in the area of HIV-TB. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to present. I was told I was supposed to say something interesting about myself, and this is probably something about myself that's only interesting to this crowd, but I actually have had TB. I had bovis from unpasteurized milk when I was 4 years old, and I suffered through 2 years of streptomycin injections. So here's the face of Mycobacterium bovis. Making it personal to all of you. Most of you have seen these slides. I just want to briefly, for those one or two people who do not know about PEPFAR, let you know that it is for the first 5 years, we're a $15 billion comprehensive program for HIV/AIDS. It's been in multiple countries. It's a collaboration with international, national, and local leaders worldwide for prevention, treatment, and care programs for HIV. Through the first 5 years, we were authorized to have $15 billion, but we were actually appropriated $18.8 billion, which is a little unusual, but it was because we were able to show we had very good accountability for the monies and were able to make good progress. I'm happy to say that we have been reauthorized for another 5 years, and in the authorization bill, it authorizes up to $48 billion to combat three diseases: $39 billion for HIV, for PEPFAR and the Global Fund, $4 billion for bilateral programs to fight tuberculosis, and $5 billion for malaria. I do want to point out, for those of you who don't really understand the U.S. system, that this is an authorization and not an appropriation, so we still need to wait for Congress to give us a funding level for every year, but these are sort of ceilings. These are the countries. The red countries represent focus countries, and the blue countries are bilateral countries. And during the first 5 years, we have had some progress. 12.7 million pregnancies have been protected by prevention of mother-to-child transmission. 1 million women have received antiretroviral prophylaxis, We estimate about 194,000 infants have avoided infection. Antiretroviral therapy has been given to 1.64 million people, and we expect to meet our original goal of putting 2 million people on antiretroviral therapy. 6.6 million people have received care, and that would include TB HIV care, and 33 million counseling and testing sessions for men, women, and children have occurred. Specifically for TB, there has been over the last 4 years a 700% increase in funding levels from $18.8 million in 2005 to $169 million in 2008, specifically for TB HIV activities. And it's estimated that approximately about 367,000 people who are co-infected have received support and care. The types of activities that we do include supporting services for people with TB, improving TB diagnostics and treatment for people with HIV, improving the TB and HIV collaboration. It also includes provision of testing for TB patients, supporting clotrimoxazole and isoniazide preventive therapy, and TB screening and PEPFAR care and treatment programs, including infection control, implementing DOTS and working with the World Health Organization on recommended international standards, TB drug resistance surveillance in 6 countries, improving laboratory surveillance, including surveillance for MDR and XDR TB, and strengthening integrated HIV, TB, and also malaria lab capacity. We work closely with the Global Fund because we are providing 30% of the fund's resources. We also collaborate closely with the in-country teams of the Global Fund to make sure that there's complementarity between our programs. We also are working closely with WHO on country-level collaborations, specifically in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Rwanda, and supporting also WHO and the Stop TB partnership. These are some of the results, as you can see. These were also mentioned by Ambassador Dybul yesterday in terms of increased testing of HIV in TB patients, clotrimoxazole coverage, and uptake of ART by co-infected patients. So when I was looking at just what kind of focus and services and programs there were in both TB clinics and HIV clinics, there's a tremendous amount of overlap. And if you look at what type of prevention has to occur at a TB clinic for HIV, you're looking at condoms. If you're looking in an HIV clinic and looking about prevention for TB, you're looking at provision of IPT. When you're screening in a TB patient for HIV, you're looking at HIV counseling and testing, and then screening for TB in HIV clinics. But then after that, in terms of treatment, provision of ART in TB patients, clotrimoxazole, infection control, and regular follow-ups are the same in both types of clinic settings. So it asks the question, which model is the best for collaboration? Should it be a model of referral, a model of partial integration, or a model of one-stop services for TB patients with HIV? And throughout our programs, we see different types of models. We certainly endorse the three I's as promoted by WHO and outlined in Ruben's talk. And I'd like to just give you some examples throughout our different programs of what kind of progress is being made. And these are just specific programs. I'm not going to do a composite. But first, let's look at intensified TB case finding, but also look at intensified HIV finding in TB patients. So in terms of identifying TB and HIV clinics, we're using symptom algorithms, chest X-ray, and cough monitors. And in a few cases, we are using Haynes test. And in terms of identifying HIV and TB clinics, we're looking at provider-initiated counseling and testing, and then contact tracing of families who can come to the clinic, and then sometimes outreach contact tracing to the home. This is an example from Mozambique, and it looks at a TB clinic, and 74% of the TB patients were tested, 95% of TB HIV patients were referred to ART services, and 89% of co-infected patients were provided with clotrimoxazole. But let's look at what the progress was for screening of HIV patients for TB. In the first quarter of 2007, only 26% of the patients were screened for TB. After the adoption of an algorithm, 50% were then screened. And this tool that has been developed by the ICAP program in Mozambique, and these slides are courtesy of David Hoos, has now been adopted as the national screening tool for screening of TB and HIV-infected patients. Tanzania is another country where they have instituted intensified case findings, and as you know, Tanzania ranks 14th among the 22 highly burdened TB countries. It also has a six-fold increase in TB since 2004, between 1983 and 2004, and it has about 2 million people affected with HIV. So 50% of TB patients are co-infected with HIV, and those HIV patients account for a 60 to 70% increase in the TB patients. So HIV is driving the TB epidemic, and you will not be able to control these epidemics. There's really one epidemic, and we really have to look at controlling TB, HIV to control TB and vice versa. The HIV program challenge was to find the TB cases and then to put forth infection control. This just shows you what, in 2006, that they had about 50% of patients tested or who were HIV positive were 50% of TB patients were tested for HIV, and only about 50% were started in clotrimoxazole. So what they did was they trained TB service providers in provider-initiated counseling and testing, provided the kits, modified the TB registered, and then had monthly meetings between the National TB Program and the clinic staff, the HIV clinic staff. And then we see 2 years later that now 83% of the patients were being tested for HIV, and the almost 100%, 98% were being referred to the HIV clinics when they were positive, and 98% were receiving clotrimoxazole prophylactic therapy. So what were the reasons for some of the success? Well, one was that they had a very well-organized national TB program at both the central, regional, and district level. There was 100% DOTS coverage. There was success in the DOTS program. And there was a national policy for collaborative activities between TB and HIV, and I think that's really important to be fostering those national interactions between the two programs. There also was a national policy for provider-initiated counseling and testing. And also they had decentralized a lot of the antiretroviral therapy to the primary facilities so that much of this was happening at the same facility. The other thing is that there were specifically earmarked funds that were specifically earmarked by PEPFAR for TB HIV activities, and I think that was an important piece as well. However, when you look at the TB cascade for for TB testing within HIV clinics, again, as in Mozambique, we're not seeing the same kind of progress. So if we look in the first quarter of 2007 through the first quarter of January to July of 2008, we see that there has been some increase in screening, but still not the number of case detections that we had hoped to have. So what did we find in the clinical HIV clinics was there was very poor recording. There was no code for TB screening on the antiretroviral registers. There was no screening at HIV identification points. So in terms of VCT or PMTCT, there was no TB screening, just HIV screening. There was very little monitoring, and as usual, there was very inadequate human resources. So some of the program advocacy that PEPFAR is recommending for intensified TB case finding is making sure that there's a screening tool of some sort that looks at history and use of clinical questions, extends to suspected family members and close contacts of co-infected persons, making sure that there's AFB, sputum microscopy, and aspirates, and results available within 48 hours at the same facility, having some availability of culture, histological examination, and tuberculin test, also opportunities for chest X-ray, understanding that chest X-ray alone is not reliable, and that there's for all patients at enrollment, and that those who are suspected of having TB at least get a chest X-ray during treatment. And there does seem to be some increase response when there is co-location of TB and HIV clinics. There obviously are issues with diagnostics, that having a centralized procurement and also having a program on intensified laboratory integration has been helpful in terms of having sufficient diagnostic tests, looking at capacity and increasing facilities, looking at quality assurance, and trying to, through bulk procurement, decreasing the high cost of both instrumentation and consumables. You saw the slide yesterday from Ambassador Dybul, but it looks at Rwanda, which is one of the success stories, and you can see here the kind of progress that they've been making in terms of the number of patients tested, the number of patients on clotrimoxazole and on ART. So I think there have been some successes. It's, I think, a large part due to the fact that there's improved awareness. There have been the development of guidelines and training materials, and WHO has taken leadership on this. There has been skills development among the healthcare workers. And I think strengthening the monitoring and evaluation, especially at the HIV clinics, will be very helpful when people have to report on the percentage of patients that are being screened and then placed on either IPT and clotrimoxazole. And then also developing capacity among local and the community groups and involving medical institutions. But I would say overall there are many challenges from the multiple country practices. We see that the screening tools, they vary from country to country, and there's often poor recording and no code for TB screening on ART registers. There's little or no screening at HIV identification points, PMTCT, VCT. And then more and more specific constitutional symptoms and signs are being included in the tools. That's good. However, children and extrapulmonary TB have mostly not been addressed. There also needs to be a presence of a nationally recommended screening tools. And even when they exist, though, they're not always guaranteed implementation. And then a recurring theme I think you've heard throughout this meeting is that the inadequate human resources. I'm just going to say a little bit about IPT. There's lots of data that you all know better than I. And I'm just going to quickly show it because my point is this, that despite the data in the programs that I looked at, there was very low uptake of IPT. And I assume that some of it's due to fear, the side effects, the low adherence, and the resistance. I think some of it, too, is on unclear policy. And I think that we need to have clearer policy, and even from our headquarters. And often it's left to the national TB programs to promote this. And really the question is, in whose domain is INH? It should be in the domain as well of the HIV implementers. There seems to be not a lot of involvement from the national AIDS control programs over this, and there needs to be a lot more community engagement and literacy. So let me talk a little bit now about the third I, infection control. And certainly there are challenges. I think you've all been in these clinics. There's no screening at the HIV identification. When a patient is in a TB clinic and positive for HIV, quickly referred to the HIV clinic. They're congested, no triages, no breathing space, and inadequate human resources. And it's rare that we actually are taking the time to make sure that we have infection control and protecting our inadequate human resources, because we really need to do a better job for wellness of our limited healthcare staff. PEPFAR does a lot of renovations and does a lot of new construction, and we are now saying that in any renovation or new construction, it has to be cleared by an infection control group to say that the design of the renovation or new construction is supportive of TB infection control. And in those places that have already been built, we are asking that they take the WHO guideline health facility score and make sure that they are sort of certified. This is an example of a recent use of that score in two places in South Africa. This is from the ICAP program there. And you can see here in one setting, they found an unused courtyard where they began to triage patients to and let them have the triage patients with cough wait in this open air place. And in another newly built facility, what they found, it had high ceilings. The windows were inaccessible, and they were not using the exhaust system. So even though you may have something cleared, there does have to be ongoing review. So what are the lessons learned for strengthening TB and HIV collaboration? Well, I think we have to first acknowledge the challenges. One is of system strengthening, and I think that's been the theme of this meeting, and I'm not going to reiterate all we've learned. We have to be wary of the creation of parallel health systems. And sometimes when we have a lot of new implementers, we do have to make sure that they don't undermine the responsibilities of the ministry. We need to expansion of good practices. We especially need to deal with these poor infection control systems because we don't want the treatment of HIV to lead to the increase in the TB epidemic and to the undermining of our limited healthcare resources. And we also have to invest in the availability of human resources. We need to work with TB programs, and we also have to address logistics and assure that there's access to treatment, including clotrimoxazole and ART. I'm not going to go through the lessons learned from the laboratory, but let me quickly talk about lessons learned depending on the point of entry. So lessons learned from the HIV point of entry is that routine screening for TB at every clinic visit should allow the healthy HIV-positive person who's pre-ART to receive clotrimoxazole in IPT, and that clinicians treating patients with TB and HIV should be aware of the benefit of HIV infection by treating TB and offering supportive care alone and additionally ART. We need to make sure efforts to identify patients with TB and HIV early in their disease, because that is when we will have the most tangible benefit. We also need more studies to better identify in what settings, when, and how to initiate ART in patients receiving TB, and HIV care programs need to have a TB infection control plan. We also need to think about management and training. At this point in time, it may be worthwhile having an HIV focal person in the National TB Program and a TB person in the National AIDS Control Program, and development systems to assure that TB-related technical and logistic issues are addressed. And that could be at the facility level, making sure of appointing a TB-HIV lead or a TB-HIV committee in healthcare facilities, and ensure that all staff receive training on TB-HIV and protection against TB. So this sounds like a WHO list, but I'll National Strategies, Recording
okay
Tools.
We've
seen them all before. But let me just end here with some of the issues that still need to be addressed and strengthened. We obviously need to increase HIV counseling and testing uptake, but we're making good progress on that. But we especially need to focus on TB screening and diagnostics in HIV positive and early initiation of ART in TB patients who test HIV positive. We need to further look at what's the most suitable place or systems to provide follow-up to co-infected patients. And we need to desperately strengthen infection control. We need to deal with the MDR-XDR TB threat. And we need to rationalize indicators. We need to harmonize donor and PEPFAR indicators and Ministry of Health and National TB Program indicators. And we need to look at both patient-level outcomes and program performance. So in conclusion, HIV-associated TB is a public health concern, and I call it actually the hyper-epidemic. I used to think the hyper-epidemic is in southern Africa, but I actually think the TB-HIV epidemic in southern Africa is the hyper-hyper-epidemic. Good progress is being made with decreasing the burden of HIV in TB patients, but slow progress is being made with decreasing the burden of TB in HIV patients, and the three I's will play a critical role. We need greater collaboration between the TB and HIV communities. And the HIV community, and I'm speaking as someone from the HIV community, needs to take a greater role and responsibility in the implementation of TB-HIV collaborative activities, and especially the three I's. And I'd like to end on sort of a whimsical note. I'd like to add a new three. So we've had the three ones in HIV. And then in HIV-TB, in TB, there's the three I's. So now I'd like to add the three in ones and say that clotrimoxazole prophylaxis is actually three in one. So you get three diseases for one prophylaxis for one drug. And I'd also like to acknowledge the following people and end with a suggestion for an HIV-TB ribbon. Now, I don't know... I don't know if you have a ribbon in TB, but if you don't, I would suggest you have a blue ribbon for fresh air. And I think if you take the HIV red ribbon and the TB blue ribbon, then TBHIV is the purple ribbon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ryan. It's a great talk. I wanted to introduce my co-chair. Thankfully, he's here now. It's Mark Harrington from Treatment Action Group from New York City, and he'll handle the MC from now on.
Thanks a lot, Ruben, and I want to apologize for misjudging the starting time of this session and leaving you with the double duty of introducing yourself, moderating, and then having to substitute for Kevin, who wasn't able to make it. So I truly apologize for that. It's great that we're having this session, even though there's a concurrent session in another room about infection control, so we're really either the two eyes or the four eyes, depending on if we adopt Carolyn's suggestion. But it brings me a lot of pleasure to introduce Paula Akugizibwe from the AIDS Rights Alliance of Southern Africa, which is based in Cape Town but does work in several countries in the SADC region, and she's the HIV and TB treatment advocacy and literacy coordinator at ARASA and is a really dynamic and exciting activist.
Thank you, Mark. All right, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks to the WHO and Gates, I think, for organizing this session. I'm going to be speaking about meaningful community involvement in the three I's today. Just to give you a background about ARASA and what we do, it's a regional network of HIV and human rights organizations, and the treatment, literacy, and advocacy program that I work for has two primary goals. The first is to conduct regional advocacy around issues related to HIV and TB prevention and treatment, and the second is to build the capacity of community organizations around the region to carry out treatment literacy and advocacy on these issues. This photograph that you see here is one of the community activists in Botswana at the International HIV Conference. I'm standing in front of Bonella's Stop TB Now exciting banner. So community involvement is something that I think we've all heard about throughout this conference and in general, and something whose importance we all know about now and hopefully understand. But I think the feeling from communities a lot is that although this is theoretically understood, much like TB-HIV collaboration, this knowledge hasn't really been applied rationally and concretely. And the reason that I want to talk about this today is because if we don't get serious about community involvement now, as this drive for scale-up on the three I's begins and gains momentum, and if we don't strategically make it part of the framework for scaling up the three I's, then we're going to find ourselves moving nowhere very slowly for many more years to come. But before I get to the topic of community involvement, there's two other points that I think really need to be emphasized and reemphasized around the three I's until we see some change on these. And the first point is for TB and HIV program officials. And I think it's already been raised in the talk from Caroline Ryan when she spoke about one of the reasons for success on TB-HIV collaboration being that national level interaction happening between TB and HIV programs. And unfortunately, although this is really an incredibly obvious point, it's something that's really incredibly underimplemented, although it's the foundation of all of our other efforts. And until our TB and HIV programs start working together in a structured and a consistent fashion, not the sort of sloppy, poorly structured fashion that we're more familiar with now, we're not really going to be able to make progress in this. And I mean, this is serious work that we're talking about. We're talking about joint planning and budgeting, harmonizing guidelines, joint capacity building, monitoring and evaluating programs together, having a TB point person in the AIDS program and vice versa, as was suggested by the previous speaker. If we can't get this right at the top, we're never going to see integration of services and proper collaboration on the ground, which of course means that we're never going to make any substantial progress against the TB-HIV co-epidemic. So we have to get that right. And we could probably get it right a lot quicker if the people who are funding these programs were convinced of the importance of getting it right. And that leads me to my second point, which is that it's hugely problematic that donors are still sending the message that the three I's are an advisable initiative but not an imperative one. The fact that the Global Fund continues to accept and fund HIV and TB proposals, especially HIV proposals, that lack adequate TB-HIV collaboration is condoning and encouraging continued public health negligence on this co-epidemic. Swaziland, which is one of the highest, has one of the highest incidence rates for HIV as well as for TB, has never had an HIV proposal with any TB-HIV activities. Since the recommendation on collaboration was introduced in the technical guidance, more countries are mentioning this in the proposals, but if you look closer, you'll see that these proposed activities are quite vague and lack any structure. For example, Botswana has mentioned TB-HIV activities, and I think there are around 5 proposals, but didn't actually make any budget allocation for this. So it's just there without any money attached to it. It's bizarre. And the fact that the Global Fund are accepting some of these proposals is really problematic. HIV and TB proposals, which do not show proper collaboration and which do not demonstrate commitment to scaling up the 3Is, are substandard proposals. And the Global Fund needs to stop sending the message to countries that this is okay. Now, moving on to the focus of my talk, which is community involvement. Let me just start by saying that giving community representatives the opportunity to attend forums such as these and to have their voice heard in these settings is a good step, and it's an important step, but it does not necessarily equate to meaningful community involvement. And I'm mentioning this because I think the feeling is often that when health authorities talk about community involvement, what they're really talking about is community representation as and when needed. Or even where they are referring to active community participation, this is often seen as an add-on to the core content and structure of programs. That's not meaningful community involvement. When we talk about meaningful community involvement, we're talking about strategic and long-term approaches to building capacity of and to comprehensively integrating communities in the health response. And this means, for example, that if you're coming up with a TB-HIV strategy, communities have to be involved in the strategizing. If you're planning and executing implementation of such strategies, communities need to be able to identify and carry out the roles that they're able to play in these strategies. It also means that when you monitor and evaluate a program, you do not, as the Botswana government did a few months ago, cut out community representatives who have voiced criticism of your actions in the past, but that you uphold the rights to voice these criticisms and that you treat the concerns with the same gravity as you treat the concerns if they're coming from the top. Communities are not simply, as we so often hear, only, you know, the ultimate beneficiaries of programs who should be brought on board when it serves the needs or the purposes of health programs, but rather they should be seen as integral designers, implementers, and monitors of these. And to do this requires a pretty dramatic change in the way that our health responses are structured, particularly the response to TB-HIV. And in some places, we've seen that these changes have taken place. In Malawi, for example, they've formally integrated community health workers or health surveillance assistants into the formal structure of the health system. The management of drug-resistant tuberculosis in Lesotho is propped up by the work of community health workers, trained members of the community who administer treatment, who monitor side effects, who support adherence. And such models, although they have demonstrated high levels of success, continue to be the exception in our health responses. And yet the common thread in all of the success stories in TB-HIV collaboration, at least in Southern Africa where I work, the common thread running through all of these stories is extensive and meaningful community involvement. And we know this, and I think it's time for us to stop, you know, nodding thoughtfully over these models and conferences and clapping about them and actually start replicating them in all of our countries. And why is that important? First of all, health systems simply do not have the capacity to initiate and sustain comprehensive scale-up of the 3Is. This is a quote taken from MSF South Africa's report that was issued last year entitled Help Wanted, about the human resources crisis that we're so familiar with and that once again has been brought up by previous speakers. And it says, as you can see, without fundamental change, the perspectives, I guess that was meant to be perspectives for expanding access to ART and improving quality of care are bleak. And the cost of inaction is clear. Hundreds of thousands of people will die unnecessarily because there will be no personnel to provide the life-saving care and treatment that they need. This is a pretty frank recognition of the fact that we all know, which is that health systems are absolutely unable to keep up with the demand created by HIV and, by association, the demand created by TB-HIV. They desperately need help to do what they need to do. And in countries that are willing to be proactive and pragmatic, such as Malawi and Lesotho, which I referred to earlier, and other projects scattered through different countries, this help has been found through the engagement of communities. If we're serious about scaling up the 3Is, then we also need to get serious about who is actually going to be doing the scaling up. We need to rethink our approach to health and come up with concrete and sustainable strategies for scale-up, which make use of all of the resources that we have. And communities, of course, are one of the most valuable of these resources. Failure to tap into this, which is a huge resource and a much-needed one, will make all of our other efforts pointless and self-defeating. Additionally, even if health systems were able to, even if they had the capacity to handle scale-up of the three I's without enlisting the help of communities, it would not be constructive for them to attempt to do so. And this is because health is a shared responsibility, and this shared responsibility is in itself also a right of communities. We're all familiar with the idea of ownership and the fact that health outcomes are more likely to be positive if patients feel that they have ownership of these outcomes, and if they perceive themselves to be not just recipients of health services, but actually partners in these health services. And the paternalistic approach of many health authorities, and this is particularly true for TB because I think HIV has made a lot more progress in this regard, this paternalistic approach to healthcare is really disempowering, and quite frankly, it's actually just stupid. And if you need any proof of that, you can just look to South Africa, where DRTB patients have been locked up in the name of infection control, and the extent to which they've refused to cooperate with treatment to the point of resorting to violence in the resistance to these measures. Shared responsibility for health is essential, and it's especially important for the three I's because the success of them relies on changes that take place outside the scope of clinics and hospitals and other boundaries of a traditional health response. Intensified case finding, for example, implies the need for active outreach, actually going out and finding cases in communities. Infection control in homes, in communities, in congregate settings requires that community involvement. IPT requires people to adhere to a six-month course of treatment for a disease that either that they've never actually tangibly experienced or haven't experienced recently. And this degree of adherence, as we all know, will require extensive community support. And a study done on adherence from a provision of IPT to children in South Africa a couple of years ago suggested that one of the reasons why the adherence rates in the study were so low was because parents saw other children in the community who had not completed IPT, who were perfectly healthy and hadn't fallen sick, and because they lacked the understanding of this intervention, they didn't realize how important it was for their own children to complete the course of treatment. And I think this just clearly shows that community health interventions, which do not involve broader community empowerment, are futile. If we want to treat patients successfully, then they and the communities have to become active stakeholders in this treatment. And by making them active stakeholders in health, we also ensure that the approaches that we design are acceptable and will meet the needs in reality, because approaches that are not acceptable to patients, that are not patient-centered, are doomed to fail, and it's as simple as that. I mean, I've already spoken about the madness of isolation. Just earlier this morning, I got an email from one of the treatment activists in Botswana, the one who's featured on the title slide, about a group of TB patients in the region where he works, which is in the desert area of Botswana, highest rates of TB in the country. And these people have now made the decision to default from the TB treatment, some of them for the fourth time, simply because they are expected to walk 10 kilometers to the clinic every day to receive their directly observed therapy. And I mean, that's crazy, 10 kilometers one way and 10 kilometers back, 20 kilometers every day for someone who's sick, someone who has other responsibilities. And you have to ask yourself, who is coming up with these programs? That is completely unrealistic. Have communities been consulted on this? Because if communities were consulted on this, it would be quite obvious from the start that such an approach was doomed to fail. ARESA was recently involved with the Southern African Treatment Access Movement on the production of a regional treatment barometer, which has used community activists as researchers to identify what the major barriers to treatment are in the communities. And most of the barriers that were identified that came up repeatedly are things that you won't really find in a clinical textbook, you know, things like transport, distance to clinics, people don't have money to take a bus to get the treatment, so they don't get it. Food is scarce and people can't take the pills on an empty stomach. In some low-income communities in South Africa, people have said, well, you know, ventilation is great for infection control, but we can't open our windows, it's not safe, tell us something else. These are the realities that you don't get in a medical textbook, and the most theoretically sound programs that we could design cannot be able to squeeze these realities into shape. Programs need to be fitted to the realities of patients, not the other way around. And in order for this to happen, patients and their communities need to be involved in the design of these programs. And, I mean, this is not just an idealistic sort of clamoring for the seat at the table argument. The fact is that communities, when they're equipped with knowledge and skills, have the capacity to become indispensable partners and sometimes even leaders in designing, implementing, and monitoring TB-HIV programs. As I said at the start of my talk, ARESA's primary mandate is to build such capacity in community groups, and we've seen firsthand, we're surrounded by examples of the impact that this has on health responses, on improving health responses, particularly in the area of TB-HIV. And I'll give a few examples. The Botswana Treatment Literacy Coalition, which has taken on TB as one of their major campaigns now, has been doing extensive community education around infection control. And a few months ago, they produced a public service announcement on infection control in homes and communities, which ran on primetime television for about 10 weeks. And the response that they got from people in the community was overwhelming. It's clear that people want this knowledge, and when they have the knowledge, they're willing to apply it. But someone needs to be able to put it in a package that's understandable to them and get it out there. And communities are well placed to take these steps. The Lesotho Treatment Literacy Coalition, which is only a few months old, will soon be using a simple storyboard, easy-to-understand flip chart designed by RASA to take TB treatment literacy messages to the most rural, hard-to-reach areas of Lesotho. In South Africa, the Treatment Action Campaign conducts door-to-door campaigns, going to people's homes, giving them information about TB, encouraging early case detection, promoting infection control. MSF in Khayelitsha, South Africa, also uses trained community members as infection control practitioners to promote infection control in homes and healthcare facilities. And throughout this conference, there have been numerous examples as well. CREATE studies in Brazil and Zambia, which have used community members for their enhanced case finding, which is now responsible for a large number of the diagnosed TB cases in these settings. The CDC in South Africa has been using home care workers for ART to do screening for TB. The Protection Agency in the UK yesterday told us about how they use expert patients to encourage testing of TB in vulnerable groups. So clearly the capacity is there, the potential is there, and it's just something that needs to be tapped into. But it also requires long-term capacity building of communities so they can assume a more active active role in the health response. And this isn't something that will happen without that long-term planning. And the planning, by the way, also requires that contribution of communities to the health response needs to be recognized and compensated. And I've put some very subtle dollar signs there that you'll see. It's something that, you know, that we don't talk about as much, and, you know, volunteers get stipends every month, so we need to be realistic about this. And if we're going to ensure motivation and sustainability, we need to compensate these workers who are part of the health system adequately for the work that they do. And the Global Fund, for example, has health system strengthening components that can provide resources for this, and we need to see countries taking more advantage of these resources. And finally, meaningful community involvement ensures accountability. And the lack of accountability in the response to TB-HIV is leading to continued and gross public health negligence in this. In our treatment literacy workshops, when we explain to people how TB-HIV should be managed correctly, they often start relating this back to their own experiences and bringing up examples of how opposite things were done in their cases. The infamous Mthandazo Sibanda case in Botswana of the deported MDR-TB patient was a classic example of lack of accountability, where a patient is criminalized for non-adherence, where the health worker who omitted a crucial part of his treatment for months appears to get off scot-free. A few weeks ago, we got an email from a doctor in Pakistan relating the story of an HIV-TB co-infected patient who was extremely ill, who had experienced severe mental illness leading to treatment interruption as a result of poor education and monitoring of the side effects of the TB treatment that he was on, and as a result of lack of socioeconomic support for him to access this treatment in an uninterrupted way. And, of course, pure negligence was also reported on behalf of the hospital staff who were dealing with him. And the question asked by the doctor who shared the story was, if Wasim dies, who will be responsible? And I think this is one of the major unanswered questions that we have in TB-HIV. Who is responsible? How many of the deaths that we are seeing and that we have seen in the past were completely avoidable? Will we ever know? Will we ever try to know? And if we do know, who do we hold responsible for these? Who do we hold responsible for the disastrous infection control in our communities and in our healthcare facilities? Who do we hold responsible for the continually shocking lack of TB screening in people living with HIV, or for the failure to roll out IPT, which the data overwhelmingly shows is a much-needed intervention? How much more debate will it take before we actually start seeing these interventions implemented? Real partnerships with communities will give us the space to start having this sort of dialogue openly, and which, that's the only thing that will ensure that we're finally in a position to hold each other accountable. And finally, some acknowledgements to people who made contributions to this presentation, which was co-authored with the extensive input of Cindy Kalemi from the Botswana Treatment Literacy Coalition, who's sitting at the back. Also, Leslie Odendal, Arnold Sokwa, treatment activists from across Southern Africa who are driving the call for better access and quality of treatment HIV services in the communities. Joanna Ngala and the TAC treatment literacy trainers who have been very supportive of Arasa's work to scale up community treatment literacy and advocacy. And finally, organizations like MSF and PIH who have recognized the importance of community involvement and are really making groundbreaking strides in this regard. I hope we'll all emulate the examples in the future. Thank you.
So if there are any questions, a clarifying question? If not, then we'll go to the next speaker and we'll have some time for discussion at the end. But if there is any question, we could entertain one or two. Okay. Looks like we'll...
There's one.
I see nothing. Great. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Matt Kavanaugh from Results. And I guess I would just love to hear a response perhaps from Caroline about kind of in response to what Paula was saying. I mean, she kind of, I think, really meaningfully laid out a lot of what needs to happen moving forward, especially as it comes to TB-HIV. I guess the one question that really comes to my mind is that we've got TB-HIV over and over and over again becoming this kind of when we get to it piece. You've clearly laid out what needs to happen. You've clearly laid out that it can happen in programs that are working. Question becomes, will you actually commit to pulling everyone together, all of your grantees, all of your country teams, to say, what's the plan, everyone, so that next year this is done? Because it does seem like we've got a piece, and we were speaking with Ambassador Deibel, who said, we put money on the table and it was left there for TB-HIV. The challenge becomes, often our country teams are paid by the U.S. government, right? I mean, we're talking about CDC leaving PEPFAR money on the table. That should be completely unacceptable. And if it means that we need to kind of figure out how to go to the Secretary of State to fix it, then cool, let's do that. But like, what's our plan here to make sure that, you know, everybody gets pulled together and it's really clear by next year this will be fixed, or else we continue to kind of do bad programming.
Carolyn, want to take a shot at that?
Well, I don't speak on behalf of the TWG, so I'll just speak on behalf of myself, because I don't know if there's anybody from the Technical Working Group here. I think they're all in the infection control, which is good, because we need infection control. But I do think there's a few things I'd like to say. I think that you're absolutely right, that we need to have sort of these are things that we're going to monitor, and that what we monitor are indicators, and what we also have control over are contracts. So the two things that we can do is we can make sure that there are indicators that would follow the three I's, and that people have to report on that. And programs will have to be responsible. They'll have to have targets, and they'll have to meet those targets. I think we have some kind of – we do have a track record for trying to follow – that's how we got people on treatment. And I think we'll just have to have those targets. The other thing is I think we're going to have to put targets – and clear descriptions of what is going to be the programs we're looking for into contracts with implementers. So I say those would be two ways that I think we can move forward.
Thank you. Thank you for that response. Another question? Please.
Thank you very much. My question is on cotrimoxazole. I've seen that on the previous two speakers, they mentioned the cotrimoxazole prophylaxis. And we know in medical school, we said that an antibiotic which has been used for quite long, it can even attack the normal flora. And my question is that are we giving cotrimoxazole for prophylaxis knowing that it doesn't develop resistance or what? Because we have seen that cotrimoxazole has lost its normal prescription, I mean, its normal usage. I don't know now in those bacteria or on those organisms which we give to prevent the infection, if it does work. My question is that does the pneumocystic arena, the Cherokee, it doesn't develop resistance or what? Because we have seen that chloroquine has been removed out of the market. And today, cotrimoxazole has become a daily, routinely prescribed, which is an antibiotic. Is this a pharmaceutical promotion or a reality from a medical point of view?
Well, cotrimoxazole is used to prevent a number of infections, including pneumocystis in people with HIV. It also prevents some bacterial infections and malaria. And I'm not aware of any data that suggests that the use of cotrimoxazole by HIV-infected people has led to any kind of outbreak of resistance to cotrimoxazole when used as a treatment, which is at a different dose for pneumocystis. And many, many studies in many parts of the world, many parts of Africa, and in adults and in children have demonstrated a very strong survival benefit to taking cotrimoxazole in HIV-infected individuals at many CD4 cell levels and on or not on ART. So I think it's important to look for resistance to common antibiotics, which are widely used. But at the same time, it's important not to be so afraid of resistance to commonly used antibiotics that we don't use them, because then if you don't use them, the person will then get all the infections that you're trying to prevent, and you'll be protecting the drug at the expense of the patient.
I can actually add a little bit to that. In the studies that were done in Uganda and a couple other places, there were high rates of resistance among endemic flora if you just cultured throats or something like that. But in fact, in settings where there was high rates of resistance among pneumococcus and non-toffee salmonella, there still was effectiveness of cotrimoxazole with regard to both pneumocystis as well as bacterial infections. So it seems to be able to be working for prevention in those settings, because it's preventing a multitude of things. So it works still.
Our next speaker is Dr. Stephen Lawn, who's a British researcher based in Cape Town, working at the Desmond Tutu Center for HIV and TB Research, and he was recently a winner of the Union's Young Investigator Award, and he's also done some of the most important work of around TB and HIV in peri-urban communities in South Africa.
Good afternoon. Thank you to Nick and Renee for organizing this important session, and to Mark and Ruben for co-chairing this. I'm going to be talking to you today about the three I's in a specific clinical setting. And I'm going to take you to South Africa, which is, as we all know, the slides don't seem to be moving. Okay. Is very much at the epicenter of the TB and HIV epidemic. If we look at rates, notification rates of TB in South Africa over the past 100 years, you can see there's been an astounding rise in notification rates in the past 15 years in tandem with the HIV epidemic. Rates here represent notified cases, but if you look at estimated total burden, it looks far worse. The current estimated rate for 2006 was 940 per 100,000 per year. And I think, you know, South Africa has never had as much TB as it has today, and something needs to be done radically to reverse this situation. I have the privilege of working at the University of Cape Town in this beautiful city. But again, I always refer to the three oceans. There's the Atlantic to the west, there's the Indian Ocean to the east, but here in the townships, is a third ocean, an ocean of TB and HIV. We've been doing studies over a number of years. This presentation isn't moving on. Okay. We've been doing studies in a population-based study in a community, poor community to the south of Cape Town over the past a number of years, and we've reported on the burden of TB that has risen in tandem with the HIV epidemic. And this is a community that served with a very well-run TB clinic that has lots of certificates to say how well it is doing. And despite implementing DOTS to a high standard, this is what the burden of TB has done in from 1996 to 2004. And this is an old slide, and the rate continues to rise, and there's been a disproportionate increase in smear-negative and extrapulmonary disease, as well as a rise in smear-positive disease. And if we look at HIV prevalence rates, they've plateaued at around 30% among young adults. And even though the HIV prevalence has plateaued, TB rates have nevertheless continue to be amplified and are still rising. Again, I say this is an old slide, just to 2004, but the rate in the whole community now exceeds 2,000 per 100,000 per year, which is almost unprecedented in the era of modern antimicrobacterial therapy. And it's often said that we cannot treat our way out of the HIV epidemic with antiretrovirals. I would also add to that, we cannot treat our way out of the HIV-associated TB epidemic with TB therapy. TB therapy, DOTS, is an essential foundation, but it's not the solution to this epidemic. So even where it's well implemented, it's not enough. And that's where we need TB prevention in HIV-infected people, which is really why we're meeting today. We need to add on to DOTS TB prevention in HIV-infected people. I'm going to be focusing particularly on the specialized situation of antiretroviral treatment clinics, which are really the hot zone when it comes to problems with transmission of TB and dangers associated with drug-resistant TB being transmitted. And we've been doing studies in this other township in Cape Town called Guguletu. And it's a large population, 300,000 people. We run an ART clinic, which serves over 4,500 people. And it has quite a staggering burden of TB. We, just to explain, there are a series of 10 feeder clinics. We refer patients to this clinic. They're then screened for eligibility for ART, and we do a routine symptom screen for TB, and then they start ART about a month later. Now, how much TB comes into this clinic? Well, among patients enrolling for treatment, 52% have had one or more episodes of TB previously treated. Another quarter have got TB at baseline. They're either on TB treatment already or they have TB that's diagnosed at baseline. And then 11% develop TB in the first year of ART. It's mind-blowing. TB, obviously, in this program and many others like it across Southern Africa, is a huge cause of morbidity, the leading cause of mortality. The risk of TB transmission is obvious, both drug-sensitive and MDR and XDR TB, as exemplified by Tagulaferri 2 years ago. So the aim of this talk is really to give some data-driven insights into how 3Is might be applied in this specific context. And I want to say up front that this is probably the most difficult situation, and I'm going to talk about some of the complexities. I don't want those complexities to in any way detract from the importance of 3Is and moving forward with that, but I'm going to go through those nevertheless. And I'm going to be focusing particularly on the first 2Is, the other I's next door. So intensified case finding. We've recently done a study looking at those who enroll in our program who don't already have a diagnosis of TB. And we have actively screened them for disease. They are adults who are ART naive, not on TB treatment. We do a symptom screen. We did two sputum samples, fluorescence microscopy, liquid culture using Becton Dickinson Midget 960, a liquid culture system, a chest radiograph. We also incorporated within this study urinary lipo-rabinaminan or LAM ELISA assay. And here is our beautiful state-of-the-art sputum induction facility. Patients stand on the veranda in Cape Town's famous southeaster wind. They have their sputum taken, and any residual organisms hopefully end up nowhere near the clinic. We've looked at an initial sample of 236 patients. They have a median CD4 count of 127. 27%, more than one quarter, had culture-positive TB confirmed. For those with the lowest CD4 counts, CD4 less than 100, this was almost 40%. And I just emphasize, these weren't TB suspects a priori. This is just active screening. And those who have a CD4 count above 100 had almost 20% culture-positive TB. Drug resistance was found in 8% of TB cases, MDR in 2 out of 5. One of those had not previously had treatment. Fluorescence microscopy, how good was that at identifying these cases? Only 8 out of 62 were smear positive, i.e. the sensitivity was 13%. And again, I reiterate, this is a specialized population. This isn't generalized to all HIV-infected patients. Liquid culture took a median of over 3 weeks to become positive. So imagine the delays inherent in diagnosing TB in this setting where ZN really doesn't work and culture does work but is very, very slow. And then the time to diagnosis of drug resistance took a median of 74 days. Absolutely staggering. So patients are being either not being treated for 3 weeks, and then they're being treated for an additional 7 weeks with an inappropriate regimen before they get on to MDR treatment. And we think of the transmission risks associated with those delays. How can we pick up these people? How does a symptom screen work in this particular population? If we look at respiratory symptoms, individual symptoms have a roughly 30 to 45% sensitivity, very low, and specificity a little bit higher. If we look at systemic general symptoms, again, a little bit higher, maybe 30 to 65%, but nothing is very staggering. If we combine these in our routine symptom screen of any of cough, fever, night sweats, loss of weight, the sensitivity increases to 78%. But that means that a fifth of the cases are asymptomatic, and the specificity is very low. So we'd have to screen. We need to screen everybody, basically, who comes into this clinic. What's further interesting is that in multivariate models, what are the predictors of TB? It comes down to CD4 count. If you include symptoms in that model, symptoms are not predictive of the presence of TB. It's all explained by CD4 count. The lower you go with your CD4 count, the higher risk of TB, and those patients really do require serial testing for TB, irrespective of symptoms. What about the X-ray? How did chest radiology function in this cohort? We had X-rays on most patients. We didn't X-ray pregnant women. The sensitivity was two-thirds. One-third of TB cases had a plumb normal chest X-ray as determined by two independent radiology experts. And again, the specificity for TB was very low. So again, a limited tool. We looked at urinary LAM, the ELISA produced by Chemagen, who had been taken over by Inverness. In all TB patients, the sensitivity was 31%. However, and I say however, the specificity was almost 100%. Now, what does that mean? Well, this test potentially is going to be developed as a point-of-care test. So if I had a point-of-care test and the patient arrives on day one, urine sample dip, and I can diagnose even a third of this huge burden of TB, I'd be pretty excited. What's also more interesting is that those with the lowest CD4 counts, less than 100, i.e. those in whom diagnosis is most difficult and is slowest with culture, the sensitivity is just over 50%, and combining with ZN staining, it's a little bit higher. So if this is a point-of-care test, and I can diagnose half the TB in this lowest CD4 count category, I would be delighted. So conclusion. Intensified case finding found a very high prevalence of TB in these patients. Smear microscopy had a low sensitivity. Culture was good but slow. Symptom screening, very poorly predictive. CD4 count, but symptoms really are the key determinant or key association with presence of TB. So I think in this population, at least, we need routine culture-based screening of patients irrespective of symptoms. And again, this is where we need new diagnostics. This is where we can make a big difference. I would say that IPT would be difficult to initiate in this patient population at baseline because of the poor specificity, the very low specificity of symptoms and very low sensitivity. But we'll come back to that. This is a population that does need IPT, but I think it would be better started downstream. So that's thinking about baseline. What about during ART, instant disease? And I've already said there's a lot of disease that continues during antiretroviral therapy. You know that ART reduces your risk by 80 to 90%, many studies around the world. And this is what happens during from the time of ART initiation over 3 years, a very high rate in the first 3 months. And that's kind of, in a way, a spillover of all that asymptomatic disease suddenly presenting in the first 3 months of ART. And then long-term, our rates plateau at around 5% per year. And what does that 5% mean? That means still 5 to 10-fold higher than among HIV-negative people in the same community. So rates don't return to background. So we need additional strategies, i.e. we need IPT. Let's think about this a little bit more in a more sophisticated way, thinking not just about duration of ART, but what is your TB risk according to your CD4 count at any given time? So here I've plotted TB risk against your current CD4 count during ART. We measure these every 4 months. So we can update TB risk according to whatever your CD4 count is at any given time. And you can see that those with a CD4 count less than 100, clearly the rates are sky high, and it falls as your CD4 count rises across these different strata. And really there are three risk groups. Below 200, your risk is very high. This is where intensified case finding is needed, and where we need additional strategies. Again, here, in the 200 to 500, your rate is around 5% per year, still very high. Why don't we add an IPT there? What about those who have the optimum immune recovery? Your CD4 count gets above 500. Well, the rate is still twofold higher than among HIV-negative people. So even with optimum immune recovery, your TB rate does not return to baseline. This suggests to me that if we need IPT, we may need this lifelong. Just thinking again a little bit more about risk factors for TB during ART, because when we understand the epidemiology, then we can intervene in an intelligent way. I'll summarize this table saying it's really your CD4 count is the overall dominant risk factor for TB during ART. Your baseline variables do not affect it at all. Your age, sex, WHO stage, viral load, history of TB, no history of TB, all those things fall out in multivariate analysis. It's all determined by your current CD4 count and also to some extent by if you have a detectable viral load or not. We need to keep people's viral load suppressed, which is obvious anyway. This is a graph that summarizes the proportion of people whose CD4 count is below 200 over time, over 4 years of ART. And you can see that during the initial year of ART, a lot of people have got a CD4 count still under 200, but this gradually falls and plateaus. The reason I put this slide in is to say these people are those who have the high ongoing risk of TB. So they will be contributing disproportionately to the burden of TB within this cohort over time. So if we're going to intervene, these are the people to target in particular. Just to go back to that very high burden of TB in the first 3 months of ART, here's a complicated slide which has got slightly scrambled by their PowerPoint system, or their version of PowerPoint. I've said that your TB risk is really determined primarily by your current CD4 count. There is another factor as well. And I've said that if your CD4 count is less than 100, we'd expect a rate of around 11. But if you look at this, TB rate in the first 4 months of ART among those who have a CD4 count less than 100, it's actually 22. So in the first 4 months of ART, the TB rate is twice as high as we'd expect for that given CD4 count. The same story applies for the 100 to 200 CD4 count stratum. Your rate would expect around 7, but it's actually 14 in the first 4 months of ART. So there's something unusual about that very early period of ART. But among those with the higher CD4 counts, there's no difference. What does this mean? What does it tell us? In adjusted analyses, when we do our complicated statistics, we come up with a conclusion that there's 1.7-fold too much TB in the first 4 months of ART, which we cannot explain in terms of their CD4 count, viral load, and other factors. And that excess is confined to the first 4 months in those with low CD4 counts. And I'll say this is consistent with unmasking TB. This is people with subclinical TB at baseline, the immune system being switching on and unmasking TB, leading to the immunopathology and development of symptoms and thereby presenting in that time period. And this is very consistent and entirely consistent with data from Uganda in a pediatric cohort. TB rate prior to ART, they weren't screened for TB, ART was started, rates shoot up because you unmask the TB, you switch on the immune system so that TB then presents and the rate therefore falls thereafter. So here we now have a model to understand what goes on in ART programs, again, so we can intervene intelligently. At baseline, we have a huge prevalence of clinical and subclinical TB related to the degree of immunodeficiency. We need active case finding. I would find it difficult to start IPT at that stage because of the difficulty in ruling out active disease. Early ART, we have a very high incidence due to immunodeficiency and also unmasking TB. Long term, it's all driven, your rate is all driven by your current CD4 cell count. So what are the implications for the three I's from these data? We need intensified TB case finding at baseline. At the moment, it's culture-based and it's slow, and lack of availability in much of the world. And again, I'm emphasizing this is a specialized population in those with the most advanced immunodeficiency. This doesn't apply across the spectrum of all HIV patients. I just want to reiterate that. TB rates remain high during ART and do not return to background even when you have optimal immune recovery. We need adjunctive IPT, maybe long-term. Starting IPT at baseline seems difficult to my mind, in this cohort at least. And that to start IPT after the first 4 months of ART, when all that unmasking and subclinical disease has been flushed out, would seem an easier place to start. And there are trials that are addressing this. Maybe it is safe to start early on, but until we have the data, this is what I would suggest. IPT may benefit those with the lowest CD4 counts. They are people who are driving the TB rates disproportionately in our cohort. Serial intensified case finding may be used to target those with poor immune recovery in these cohorts. I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues with whom I work in Cape Town, Robin Woodland, Gail Becker, who are the director and co-director of the Desmond Tutu HIV Center, and the other colleagues with whom I work and have the privilege of working in Cape Town, and the London School, my academic base in London, and the Wellcome Trust who fund my work. And thank you for your attention.
Steve, I think we have time for a couple questions, and I'm going to ask the first one. I wanted to thank you for your contribution to the discussion among activists about how to take the IPT strategy forward in the South African context. And I think your work is really helpful, but I think one thing that you kept saying was in this cohort. And so I'm asking what you would recommend for a pre-ART person that was asymptomatic with a CD4 above 200 who had been being seen for a fair amount of time and seemed to be clinically stable. And what tests, if any, would you use other than a symptom screen? Would you want to test X-ray in every case? And sort of what's your algorithm for the people that are not at the really low CD4 and also sick cohort?
We cannot generalize data from one cohort to the rest of Africa. And there's a meta-analysis being done by WHO, being coordinated by Haliyesus, looking at how to do intensified case finding among HIV-infected people. And this is looking at 12 cohorts from Southeast Asia and different sites in Africa, and I think that's going to be very informative, and that's important. What I'm looking at is the worst-case scenario, those with the lowest CD4 counts in the place with the highest TB rates in the world. So that is the caveat that I draw to these data. I think the point of someone with a CD4 count above 200 who is clinically stable in care is a good one. And I think what's really essential is early diagnosis of HIV and longitudinal care. Mm-hmm. We're actually very bad at that. We are just firefighting in sub-Saharan Africa, people presenting with advanced symptomatic disease who consume huge health resources and are difficult to manage. Mm-hmm. Early HIV diagnosis, slotting people into longitudinal care so we can monitor them, put in preventive therapy, cotrimoxazole, IPT. We've got the luxury of time. We can monitor weights for 3 months. If your weight is stable and you're asymptomatic, I'm going to be pretty happy on that basis that your risk of TB is low, and we just have to look at algorithms in those different contexts. So I think that's really an important point. We need to be moving upstream.
Thank you very much. We have time for three quick questions, if you promise to not make them statements but questions. So we'll start with Renee first.
In the folks with the initial TB, the high rates, can you just clarify about cross-contamination in laboratories? Mm. You're using liquid culture. And among those 38% with TB, does this include extrapulmonary TB, or are you only talking about mm-hmm. pulmonary TB? And of those with the normal chest X-rays, again, were these all pulmonary TB? Did all of those have, in fact, positive sputum cultures?
Sure. So simply identifying people with culture, sputum culture positive TB. This doesn't include extrapulmonary TB. Next question about laboratory contamination, a hugely important issue, especially in the overworked laboratories in South Africa. We've done fingerprinting studies, paired isolates from the same patient, all had identical fingerprints. Serially screened patients on the same day or adjacent days all had different fingerprints. So we've looked into that. We're happy with the data.
Chest X-rays, those were all sputum positive.
Exactly. These are all people with sputum culture positive TB. And You know, it's been reported before that HIV-infected people with TB, between 5 and 30% of people may have a normal chest X-ray.
So we'll take over here. And actually, can I ask, just ask the speakers to introduce themselves? I'm sorry, I didn't do that before.
Actually, I'm going to – it's a comment, so I can wait till the end. So I'm going to ask you.
Okay. That's very gracious of you. We are very hopeful for that, yeah.
Okay, thank you. And I should thank two people then. Right, okay. I don't know if it's rather a question or a comment, but I want some clarification. Dr. Lund, thank you for your presentation, and I'm one of those who read a lot of your publication. What I want now is I have asked this question in another forum as well. This is about what we call, you know, asymptomatic TB or subclinical TB, or, you know, a kind of a false positive, culture positive, TB. Now, there is a lot of point of discussion now going on, you know, about what is the best screening method for TB, especially in relation to IPT. But these days, again, you know, so many things are emerging, you know, like so-called, you know, subclinical TB and so on. So my problem now is where is the differentiation between subclinical TB and false positive TB? If someone is, for example, normal chest X-ray, asymptomatic, culture positive, do we call this asymptomatic TB or do we call this false positive TB? I'm working in Botswana, and we have, you know, about 2,000 people following, you know, some are on IPT, some are on INH, some are on placebo. Mm. And we've got a lot of patients who are asymptomatic, again, culture positive. So we have a privilege of following them for more than 12 months, and none of them, you know, develop active TB.
Right.
But we saw in another setting, you know, as being categorized as, you know, subclinical TB, especially if they're HIV positive, people tend to treat them as active
thank you.
TB.
Thank you very much for your question. Can you please?
I think you need to know your laboratory and how reliable the data are from your laboratory. I think the issue of subclinical TB, and again, it depends on how you define subclinical and, you know, what constitutes a symptom and how, you know, it's a spectrum. Where you draw a line and a cutoff between symptomatic and asymptomatic is pretty gray, first comment. Second comment, Liz Corbett has done a lot of active case finding in Harare and Zimbabwe, and she reported in PLOS Medicine. She found quite a number of patients with subclinical TB. She followed them, and the majority of them progressed to symptomatic disease over a number of weeks. And I think all we're doing is we're diagnosing patients that are on the way to developing symptoms. I don't think it's a peculiar phenomenon. I suspect that people would present in due course. And again, this ties in with data from Sebastian Lucas in West Africa in the pre-ART era, that in post-mortem studies, there's a huge prevalence of undiagnosed TB. So I think all the data are consistent that this is a real phenomenon. But the key from what you're saying from your data is you need to know the reliability of your laboratory.
Thank you very much for that talk. And I'd like to introduce the next speaker. It's Dr. Joseph Sitine, who's from Kenya, who is the National TB Program, TB and Leprosy Program Manager, and has quite a few pioneering and innovative approaches to TB control there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the organizers of this meeting for inviting us to share the experience from Kenya. A lot has already been said, and perhaps being the last speaker, I'll have very little to say because most of the things will have been said anyway. That is to bring you to the attention of Kenya, that it is stuck somewhere in the East Africa, small country, not very rich. Our recurrent on health is about 9 million with a population of about 36 million. We are one of the high burden countries of the world with a case notification rate of about 338. And the HIV seroprevalence amongst the TB patients in 2007 stands at 48%. It has been oscillating between 52, 50, 48, so I think it's about 48%. And our most recent HIV prevalence shows that it is at about 7.9%. And that is just a graph to show you the trend of TB in our country. And specifically, you can also see that the smear positive cases seem to have stagnated somewhere around 111. Now, in relation to TB-HIV activities, which is our discussion this afternoon, the whole thing started around 2004 in October when the Ministry of Health did release HIV testing guidelines in clinical settings. And these HIV clinic guidelines did describe the settings, the standards for the testing, and it also established HIV testing as a standard of TB care in the context of the three Cs with an opt-out approach and was consistent with the WHO and UNAIDS statements with a focus on comprehensive care to TB patients. Of course, we appreciated that we had to deal with a patient with a dual infection, and there was need specifically to reduce stigma which was associated with HIV in our country. We also, it gave an avenue for us to test all our TB patients for HIV, and those who are dually infected to be offered what we call comprehensive care, that is to be able to access Cotrim, linkages to ARV, psychological support, and ultimately meeting all the needs of the patients. So in before we moved on, and we started sometimes in 2005 for the third quarter, we did set targets for ourselves for the year that had just ended. And in the TB settings, we actually targeted that we'll have 80% of the TB patients tested for HIV. You will see shortly where we are in relation to that. We also set for ourselves a target of making sure that 80% of the dually infected TB patients do get be put on Cotrim, and about 50% to be put on ARTs. And we are also hoping to screen about 20% of people living with HIV AIDS for TB. Perhaps somebody will ask why we set ourselves a low target, but I think part of this has already been answered, considering the difficulties that have been there in relation to the B objective of the TB-HIV collaborative activities. That is what happened in Kenya when we started this. Third quarter of 2005, we managed to test 32% of our patients, and by the end of the year 2007, we are actually testing 79%, which we think is fairly good progress. But although we are testing 79% of our patients, we are able to increase the linkages to ARVs to now we are standing at 27%. Our target was 50%. We are still working towards that. And this is because of the difficulties and the challenges we face in ensuring that we can refer the patients who are dually infected from the TB settings to the HIV settings. In Kenya, we have more than 1,900 TB treatment sites where TB patients are tested for HIV, and we have less than 500 ART sites. So you can imagine the linkages and the challenges that go with that. That is why our linkages to ART still remains at 27%. However, because we offer Cotrim at the point of testing, our patients, 86% of the dual infected patients, TB and HIV, are actually put on Cotrim. So coming to today's discussion, the intensive TB case finding, in our context, although the WHO really talks about intensive TB case finding amongst people living with HIV AIDS, ours is a little bit expanded, and we don't look at that area alone. We go beyond that, and I will show you what we are doing shortly. First, we've had the Fidelis projects, and we've had two projects of Fidelis in our country, which have recently come to an end. And I think most all of us are familiar with the Fidelis project, that they were just focusing on the smear-positive TB cases using cough monitors. We've moved to the prisons, one of the areas we think we have high HIV and also TB burden, and we have 93 prisons in Kenya, where we are moving to intensify TB case finding. In these areas, we have already sensitized the prison authorities because it was very difficult in Kenya to penetrate and to really make sure that these services are available for the prisoners and the inmates. We have developed screening tools, which I will show you later on, and these screening tools have also been owned by the prison authorities, and they are now forming part of the data of the inmates who are admitted into the prisons. We have trained healthcare workers working within those particular sites, and we've gone beyond the piloting of the tool because we have also trained the staff who are working in these areas, and we are now in the process of rolling out the use of the tool to make sure that all new inmates in all Kenyan prisons are actually screened using this symptom screen for TB. We have also moved to involve all the public health officers by training these public health officers. And last year and this year, we want to follow up all smear-positive TB cases in Kenya to using the same symptom screen to see if we can get a bigger yield of people, especially the immediate contacts. And our priorities, of course, as I said earlier, will remain HIV settings, where we are going to do the WHO model, VCT clients, HIV care clinics, patients starting on ARVs. With the public health officers that we have trained, we are also looking at the household contacts and the vulnerable groups, including the institutions that I've talked about. In the congregate settings, we have already developed infection control guidelines. These have been finalized. We are now in the process of doing the final editing and having them to be printed. The infection control in these guidelines for the ones that we've developed actually move right into the community, because the ones that we saw while we were going around, we noticed that there is very little that is discussed about the community. So we try to put something in relation to the community, and especially on the immediate family members, on what they are going to do in line with the infection control. We are also supporting 12 high-volume health facilities in Kenya to develop infection control committees. This is already in place. To identify infection control officers, we are now moving to that level, and specific infection control plans, and also to monitor infection control plans within these health facilities. I think when it comes to infection control, one of the biggest challenges will remain, how do you monitor the implementation of the activities? Because what indicators are you going to use? And we have come up with a few of them. Kenya is one of the countries where IPT is not used in everybody, but we have a policy in place. First is a policy on children, that those children who are under 5 exposed to index case, they should be put on IPT. We are also thinking that settings where adherence is possible and follow-up is also possible, especially in prison settings and in research settings, that is done. At one time, we did this in one of the parts of the country, and the adherence level was extremely low. It was coming to about 40%, and I think the experience that we saw from Botswana in one of the consultative meetings that we've had, and we've had to specifically to look at the IPT policy, whether to change or not, it still told us that we should go to implement IPT, but with a lot of caution. It will only be possible in our setting to have IPT in HIV settings when screening is conducted. But as I said earlier, the objective B in the 3 TB-HIV collaborative activities has been lagging behind in Kenya, although there is recent renewed interest, and I think this is all over the world, and we are seeing now that it is going to be possible to start thinking about a plan of doing IPT, especially if we are going to do screening. And our screening will still remain a symptom screen, which has been developed and be used in these sites. We only have one site so far that is using IPT, and that is AMPATH. It stands for Academic Model for Prevention of Prevention and Treatment of HIV/AIDS. It covers western part of the country, and we use a symptom screen that reviews cough, fever, night sweats, these type of variables, past medical history, physical examination, the way we are taught in medical schools, chest X-ray, and if the symptoms are abnormal or the chest is abnormal, then we have to do a sputum exam, and IPT is offered to patients who screen negative for TB in this particular site. And the results are there. I think some of these results were actually presented in the IS conference in Mexico. I don't need to repeat them, but between 2004, September, and February of last year, IPT was initiated in slightly more than 9,000 patients who had been screened in that particular setting. And 76% did complete the IPT for 6 months, 24% premature. Some did go on to develop TB, The results are there. And those who eventually completed INH were about 1.7% after taking the IIPT for 6 months did eventually develop TB. Some of the anticipated challenges have already been alluded to, but we expect these challenges that are put there, we are prepared for them. But of course, one of the key challenges will remain that, and that is the human resources, especially in quantity and quality, because we need people who are committed and who can be able to do the things even in difficult settings. As I showed you earlier, Kenya is not a rich country, and the burden of TB and HIV is overwhelming with few staff who are working in very difficult conditions. The other big challenge, of course, will remain the HIV interest in particular, this particular objective. As long as the HIV world continues to get interested, because most of the works will be happening in HIV settings, then we believe strongly that Kenya will take the lead as it has done in the other TB-HIV collaborative activities, and I believe by the end of next year, we should be able to share with you beautiful results. I would like to acknowledge those particular institutions, and I would like to thank you for listening to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that great talk. We do have time for one or two short questions. Clarifications. Then if I see nobody moving to the mic, maybe we could, if I could ask the speakers to please come come up to the podium and stand here with us. Not the podium, I'm sorry, the panel, the chair, the table. That'd be great. Yeah, there's room. Please come up. Just array yourself. And then I'm hoping that we have about 20 minutes here, and it would be really great to hear from all of you, comments, questions, and have a lively discussion about the three I's or any one of the speaking topics.
I've got a question.
Great. And the first question is coming from Paula. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I had a comment and question for Stephen Lawn. You mentioned that even with optimum immune recovery, one sees that the rates of TB in people living with HIV still don't return to normal, which I think is quite important because often one of the excuses for not implementing IPT is that as long as people are on ART and the immune systems are recovering, then IPT isn't, you know, necessarily a priority. But leading on from that, you suggested that IPT should therefore be a lifelong intervention. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on whether, you know, this is something that would be feasible. What do you think about the current WHO-recommended six-month regimen for IPT? Do you think that's sufficient? And also, where IPT would be administered continuously, how would you manage the need to exclude active TB if you're continuously administering this treatment?
Thank you, Paula. ART is the most effective intervention for reducing TB risk in HIV-infected people, and it leads to sustained suppression of risk, but it doesn't return to normal. So simply the fact that we need an adjunctive intervention is clear, and IPT seems like the logical one to implement. And when we're thinking about IPT, one of the key issues that people raise, well, people don't take it. Adherence is poor. But if it's in the context of a treatment program where people are coming for their ART anyway and taking their cotrimoxazole, then it seems to be a setting where compliance would be less of a problem. In terms of how long we should give it, don't know. And really, data are needed. There are trials being done. To my mind, if someone has started with a CD4 count very low and it's rising over time and they develop TB, to my mind, that suggests that exogenous reinfection may be the mechanism that predominates, because why would they suddenly have reactivation in the context of a CD4 count that is now higher? And if exogenous re-exposure is the mechanism, then perhaps the lifelong will be necessary. But basically, we're just guessing at the moment, and we don't know. It may be that, My suspicion is that in townships in Cape Town where you have rates of 1,500 or 2,500,000, that exposure, people living in a sea of TB, that lifelong would be necessary or would be advisable. But we don't know what the caveats are, what will the rates of peripheral neuropathy be, and so on and so forth. So all those really need data to inform them.
Thank you. In the back, please, could you introduce yourself as well?
Yes, hello. My name is Joost van der Meer. I am working for AIDS Foundation East West. We are dealing with HIV in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. I'm getting many concerns about IPT from medical colleagues as well as from people living with HIV in that particular context. And they argue, well, you know, we have such high rates of resistance, of MDR. Most of the people living with HIV are drug users or ex-drug users with enormously high rates of hepatitis C co-infection. Is it safe to take IPT according to the guidelines, or does it have to be adopted for that region?
Other preventive regimens are available, like 3 months of rifampicin plus... pyrazinamide's too toxic, but shorter regimens that are like 3 month regimens with rifampicin or rifapentine plus isoniazid. There was a paper shown by Neil Martinson earlier, I think at the Late Breakers, that showed 4 different regimens that were fairly equivalent in terms of their ability to prevent TB. But I think operational research would be necessary. It shouldn't be an excuse not to try preventive therapy, because also the TB burden is very high in those regions.
Yeah. Please. Thanks.
Anandate, CDC Global AIDS Program, Atlanta. Thank you all the presenters for wonderful presentations. Now, 3Is is, I'm a great supporter of 3Is, but I was struck by one slide which Dr. Lawn showed. And then I see 3Is, IPD is prevention, infection control, prevention of transmission, but what you are doing with intensified case finding is you are finding new cases and funneling them into the TB program so that they can be put into appropriate treatment and treat them. The slide you showed, in spite of implementing DOT and the case detection rate kept increasing from 1,000 to 2,000, it is glaring fact that there is something fundamentally wrong with the TB program. I don't know what kind of DOTS program they are implementing, but even if we have these 3I activities and we reach 100% of TB screening, but then we are funneling everyone to the TB program, which I think I find something wrong with the TB program. If DOTS is implemented and the number of cases is rising every day. And also, at the same time, we're talking about integration, and then anecdotally, my colleagues who have been there in South Africa have been to some of the HIV care and treatment clinics, and it talks to the quality of the TB program that there has been integration of TB diagnosis and treatment into HIV clinics, and then apparently they are treating TB patients without informing or notifying to the TB program, and it's not just DOTS. It's just distribution of pills. So I think 3Is is important, but I mean, if you are feeding the cases found into the TB program, which is very weak, we are actually fueling. It's going to the principle. No program is greater than a bad program.
I think that question's for Dr. Lawn.
Thank you. You're starting with the dogma that DOTS is sufficient to control TB in Southern Africa, and there are ample data to show that it isn't. What I showed was data from a small community where DOTS was being implemented well, and I've shown it is not sufficient. We're talking about the adjunctive interventions that need to be done. And I would take up the point that, yes, if we are doing these adjunctive interventions, it will increase the resources that are needed by the TB program to treat them. But South Africa has a huge TB problem, arguably the worst TB problem in the world. And the TB program historically has been done poorly in South Africa. Western Cape has actually been done substantially better than the other provinces. But you look at Tanzania, you look at Malawi, which have had in the IUA TLDI's model TB programs, in the context of the HIV epidemic, it has not controlled it. So we actually need to get away from the paradigm, look, TB rates are going up, we need to do more dots better. Yes, we do need to do dots and more dots better, but we need other interventions. The paradigm that controlling TB by treating infectious cases works very well in the vast majority of the world, but not in high HIV prevalence settings. And the problem is that even if you treat people, high rates of case finding and treat infectious cases, you're not addressing the fundamental problem that you have huge segments of the population who have exquisite vulnerability to TB that you're not addressing. And that's why you need these adjunctive interventions, such as ART, to raise your immune system. We need rehousing to spread people about, you know, instead of living in shacks cheek by jowl. So there are all sorts of other issues that need to be addressed. But so you hear this time and time again. We just need to do dots better. Wherever we do dots better and better and better, in this context, it's insufficient. It's necessary, and it will reduce the risk of drug resistance, but it will never be sufficient. And in 2005 in Maputo, the 43 ministers of health agreed that this was a regional emergency requiring urgent and extraordinary actions, of which I've seen none.
Actually, I'd like to thank you for that answer. And there was a very exciting session this morning talking about HIV prevention with positives. And I actually want to put Dr. Satyani on the spot, and maybe you could speak a little bit to that about what's going on in Kenya, because that I see as an effort as well to prevent HIV transmission and to actually get ahead of this TB problem.
Thank you, Ruben. I think for many years we have only been focusing on those who are not infected, trying to pass messages and to develop messages that focus on only those who are not infected to prevent themselves. But we've started a program, PWP, to focus on those who are infected to be also recruited to assist in prevention of transmission. And this program is taking root very fast in our country, and quite a lot of good positive things we are seeing are actually happening because we are now using the ones who are already infected, and it is also assisting us to destigmatize the disease, considering that these are people who are already infected and they can talk to their immediate family members and also the community at large. I think we should be able to share that experience in another forum, but that is what is taking place already.
Great. And now we're going to change the format a little bit. We're going to take five questions in succession, and we'll answer them. Quick questions. Yeah, we're hoping for quick questions. And we'll start there, and then we'll go here, here, and then there.
My name is Janet Ulate, and I work with World Vision Canada. My question is for Paula. I was in the morning in a very interesting discussion on how to engage communities in all this work. And was a big discussion about paying, not paying the volunteers of the community. You presented good arguments why this work should be recognized. My question is how this can be sustainable and in which way you see that this can continue when the funds are gone.
Right, and in sequence.
Hi.
Thank you.
Kasia Singh, I'm a public health infectious diseases physician from Melbourne in Australia. Just Dr. Law, and the patients who are smear-negative, culture-positive that you were talking about, do we have any idea or do you have any thoughts about the morbidity or transmission that might be attributable to that group of patients?
And now I'm here. Please, thank you.
Yes, hi. Nick DeLuca, Prevention Advisor for CDC Namibia. And I had a question for the panel more about the setting for the delivery of IPT. I think we've talked a lot about coming out of the ART clinics, but if you look at Botswana, the country that has some of the highest rates of IPT delivery, and I think most of that's in a primary care setting. I wonder what type of discussions there are out there on where we should deliver IPT.
Thank you, and now back.
Hi, Jesus Ketan from the Stop TB department. Mine is not a question. I would like to make a brief comment following the discussion between Anand and Steve. Regarding this referral between HIV services and also to the TB program. I think we have to start to change the scenario. We have to think and we have to work toward this HIV services. ART programs also take care of treating TB patients. And we as in WHO are really in a position to push that agenda forward because patients are lost between this referral between the two programs. But what we have to make sure is that there should be a communication and interaction, collaboration between the two programs. But in terms of sending patients from one clinic to the other is not working. So we have to make sure that the HIV services are also take the lead in treating TB patients.
And one more question, please. Thank you.
Hi. Oh, sorry. Thanks. Christine Whalen from Healthbridge International. My question is perhaps maybe to Caroline and also to Stephen. With regards to implementation, we're looking at responsible care. We're looking at ensuring that patients have access for those who need it to IPT. PEPFAR is looking at holding implementers accountable, making sure that the indicators are available so that they can measure that this is actually happening. People are committing to it and they're actually doing it. What we just heard from Stephen Lawn is a very interesting scenario and perhaps maybe not characteristic of all of you had mentioned yourself is not characteristics. It's a cohort that's quite different. However, implementers are looking for protocols to ensure that they're providing this care appropriately, and what we're seeing are different scenarios, perhaps maybe many different scenarios in many countries with high TB HIV burdens. So what is the balance? We have TB HIV, protocols from WHO, but we're also looking at a different scenario. So for the implementers, what is the approach? What should we be waiting for? Because we've already uncovered many reasons why IPT is not being done, yet we're in the balance between responsible care and appropriate care to those who need it. Thanks.
Thank you. And so if I remember the sequence right, I think the first question was for Paula, and if you could answer that. And then after that we'll move to the next question was for Steve. And then after that there was a question about IPT setting, which we can all tackle.
I think the question of engaging and compensating community health workers, you know, how can this be sustainable if when the funds run out, what will happen, just emphasizes the point that I was making about long-term planning and integration of communities fully into the formal health structure. It's not something that's traditionally been done, but some countries such as Malawi and Lesotho, which I gave examples of, where they have community health workers, these people are formally recognized by the Ministry of Health and compensated as such. And I think this is an example of the sort of urgent and extraordinary matters that Dr. Lawn was referring to that our countries have committed to making but aren't making. I don't think it's something optional that we should be saying, well, we don't have the money for it, we can't do it, because the fact is that there aren't enough human resources to do it, and the community involvement we've all seen improves treatment outcomes substantially. So to ask, you know, how can we really do this if there are no funds, I think is similar to asking how we can provide treatment if there are no funds. These are both really essential interventions. It's not an optional. It's not just a frill to the core of, you know, other programs.
Thank you. And Steve, if you could handle sure. The two questions for you just briefly, that'd be great.
I know, I'll handle the first one. The second one was for me and Caroline. I'll defer to Caroline.
Great. Nice. Well done.
Cash's question was transmission from smear-negative patients in ART settings. And it's, you know, I mentioned a session the other day. You know, some people think smear-positive equals infectious. Therefore, smear-negative means non-infectious. Well, clearly, that's not right. There's quite a lot of data now showing that smear-negative patients have roughly about a quarter as infectious as smear-positive patients. In various population-based studies in Vancouver and in the Netherlands, about a fifth of transmission at a community level was due to smear-negative disease. But I think in ART settings, where in our clinic, the preponderance is smear-negative disease, I think they're going to be accounting for a lot of the transmission. And I was speaking to some, I was asking this point of some of the docs working in the Tugela Ferry, and I think that XDR outbreak, I think all the patients were smear-negative. I don't know if anyone knows that, but that was their impression. I think the point remains that smear-negative, untreated patients are infectious. And if we're not getting a diagnosis by culture for 3 weeks, that's a problem. Sure. How do you measure morbidity in asymptomatic patients? In our clinic, TB at baseline, you have twice the mortality, even having adjusted for other variables in our more recent analysis. And TB is the leading cause of death in ART programs in sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay. Eileen, would you like to handle the other question that was directed at both of you?
Sure. I guess the question was, how can we deal with the dilemma of implementation and the balance of protocols and indicators, if I understood it correctly? And I guess taking the lead from WHO and making sure that people are fully aware that WHO has these tools and making sure they get out there, and then, but also allowing the countries to have ownership and do whatever adaptation they need to do to get to the indicators is what I would say. But I would turn it over to Ruben to say, what kind of activities are you doing in terms of the rollout of the 3Is and the tools for that?
Thanks. That was nice, Lena. I'll answer that, and I also wanted to make a comment about what setting, address the question about what setting IPT should be rolled out in. So you saw in my talk that we're actually working at WHO at the headquarters and with regional and other stakeholders on the on pulling together the ICF and IPT guidelines, and we're going to reconceptualize the way that we're thinking about IPT. The guidelines are from 1998 at this point. They're a policy statement from 1998. They're very good. I would urge everybody to take a look at them, but they need to be updated. So we will be doing that, and we will also be pulling in the meta-analysis from the from different cohorts to look at screening algorithms and these sorts of things. So very quickly, to go to the key question about what setting IPT we think that IPT should be rolled out in. Maybe this is more of a personal opinion, but I really believe that IPT should be part of actually HIV/AIDS care. And it's part of it's like co-trim. It's part of prevention. It's part of assessment for ART, which is a very good TB prevention activity. So I see this as central to HIV/AIDS care. And whoever's doing the HIV/AIDS care should then be rolling out IPT. And if that happens to be the TB program, then that's great. But it's more likely probably going to be an HIV/AIDS program or a maternal child health program or a PMGCT program or one of these other programs. And as you can see, I'm not as concerned about the label of the program. I'm more concerned about the activity, which is, I guess, a typical HIV/AIDS perspective. Do other people have feelings on the IPT setting question?
I do. I think there should be IPT activities in the TB program, and there should be IPT activities in the HIV program. And I think I got this insight from Jeremiah Chikaya, who is quite a sage in these things. And the point is that the TB program themselves in these high-burden countries should be working on preventing TB and not just on treating TB, and that the issues about human resources and money are no longer sufficient excuses in the era of the Global Fund. And then the HIV, and there's issues about kids, close contacts, non-HIV-infected patients, and that's all over the world. But I think there's a couple other points that I got out of this, the panel that I think are really worth summarizing at the end. One is, I think Paula really made it clear that the foundation of any progress will be a much greater integration of the community in the TB and HIV work that lays ahead of us. Carolyn showed us that some funders and some well-disposed recipient countries are actually making amazing progress. But I think what the missing piece of that was that we didn't hear a lot about Global Fund. And what I'm getting from Global Fund people is that they're not getting ambitious TB-HIV packages included in their either TB grant or HIV grant side. And so I think we as advocates have to work really hard with countries to make them ask for much more ambitious TB-HIV plans in both of their HIV and their TB applications so that we can get these things scaled up. I think Joseph showed us how a superstar country can really do a lot with TB-HIV scale-up, but also what some of the persistent obstacles are, and that case-finding is one of the big persistent obstacles, and so it's one that we really need to attack from a number of directions. And then I think Stephen talked about both about the obstacles, but also about, I think, I ended up very hopeful because he described a way forward with IPT that made sense, is data-driven, is evidence-based, that we can do now before the results of clinical trials are in. And I would just leave the room with one more thought, which is that it might be worth considering the development of an isoniazid cotrimoxazole polypill that you could take both for healthy pre-ART high CD4 individuals who've been diagnosed with HIV but aren't in ART care, and this would be a good way of getting people to start practice taking their medications and also to start going to adherence and support groups. And then the second group that would get this polypill would be healthy on ART individuals who have already survived 4 months of heart without developing TB. And I think it would probably have a huge impact on a number of opportunistic diseases and also on TB, if you can make it. And I think the key question now is to figure out if we can make it, and then who will fund us to do the efforts to make it, Renee?
Ouch. Well, great. Thanks a lot. First, I'd like to kind of end up here, and I wanted to thank the panelists and the speakers. I thought they were just amazing. Thanks. Let's give them a round of hands. Round of applause. Really quite good. Really quite good. And I wanted to thank Renee Ritson and Nick DeLuca who put the session together, and that's really, really great, and the union as well. And then finally, I wanted to thank you all because this is towards the end of the conference, and look, we have a packed room, and you're paying attention, so that's wonderful. Thank you.